Hi, this is Mark Talbot. I post his alt in a 20-foot radius.
Hi, this is Derek Myers. I post as Amaron at DungeonsMaster.com. And welcome to our podcast, Recounting Encounters.
A show where we talk about what happened at D&D Encounters this week.
Yeah.
Hey everybody, welcome to D&D Encounters, Season 11, War of Everlasting Darkness, Session 8, The Spell Caves of Irindlin. And this week we will talk about the finale of this season of D&D Encounters.
I think you meant to say the wonderful, fantastic finale.
The awesome finale. The phantasmal best, one of the best encounters I've ever run.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
It was. So let's, what happened at your table? Let's start with the Monday night group. Let's see what happens there.
Okay. You mean Wednesday. We always plan Wednesday as per the rules of D&D Encounters. Well, yes. So
I mix up the days of the week.
Yes. So I run with two groups. The first group, I was the DM, and the second group, I got to be a player. So with the first group, we had two tables. We had nine players. So I got the short straw in the sense that I had the small table. So I only had four players at my group. We had two strikers, a controller, and a leader. So we lacked a defender. It was definitely a tough fight. Of course, I had to scale it back a little bit because there was only four guys. No, everybody had a good time. We only ended up having one PC die during the course of the adventure. And it was great. And then in our other group, we had a full table of six that I was a player at. We had two leaders, two defenders, and two strikers. One of the defenders being the barbarian that can switch from defender to striker. We lacked a controller, which really hurt us, but having two leaders in the party sort of made up for it. It was fun. We had fun both times. The first group, I think we took about 2 hours, 45 minutes, and we got all the way through. The second group, once we hit 3 hours, we sort of had to wrap things up quickly. But by then it was, you know, the writing was on the wall. We were going to succeed. And with the second group with six players, we actually lost one player in it, or one, not one player, one character in that as well. So both tables I was at, we had one guy die dead early in the fight. But in both cases, we ended up succeeding and saving the Forgotten Realms.
Yeah,
how did things go at your store?
Well, we ended up TPK. We had two strikers, a defender, no, two strikers, a leader, and a defender. We were missing a controller also, which, like you said, hurt us, and we had no ranged characters whatsoever. Battle went on for about 12, 15 rounds, and at the end, they just couldn't keep up with it. Nanafe was way too strong. They were spending too much time attacking her, but it was great. They loved it. It was an amazing, amazing, amazing encounter.
I think that was the consensus. Even this is always how I judge whether or not an encounter was decent, especially in a situation where a PC gets killed. Because I always feel bad as the DM if I kill off someone's character. I mean, that's never my intent, but sometimes it's just that's the way the dice fall, and the players usually prefer it when you don't fudge the dice, and so. When a player character gets killed, I always ask the player afterwards. I'm like, you know, I usually apologize. Sorry, I killed your guy. But if they still say to me, look, I had a great time and I don't regret anything. I wouldn't have fudged the rolls if I was you. I'm glad you did what you did. Sort of that kind of thing. Then it was good. And in both the situations where I was, the one where I was the DM and the one where I was the player, all the players, even the ones that were running the characters that got killed said they had a great time. They thought it was a good conclusion. The larger group that I play with at the second store, like these a lot of these gamers have a little bit less experience, and like they were saying, this was the best encounter of a season, and this was such a good finale. Like they were just, everyone was talking about it after the game was over. We hung around for a little while and discussed it, which is not something we usually do at that store. So I think it really, really left a strong, good, lasting impression on these players, which, you know, is all you can ask for.
Well, They came out with a really good impression, too. We had a rogue that ran away, so I call it a TPK. Three of the players got killed. One of them ran away, but they all went away with a big smile on their faces. They had an incredible time. We had one player that got really, really frustrated, not at anybody or at anyone in particular, but the fact that, you know, tactics from start to finish kept getting screwed up. But apart from that, he came away with a huge smile. Wonderful, wonderful encounter.
Yeah. So let's talk sort of high level about what was going on. So first of all, I think what's important to note is we had this wonderful, huge map of the terrain. Now, normally with encounters, we get these poster maps, and each encounter is one half of one side. It's rare that you have an encounter that uses more than that much of the map. In this case, you had this giant cavern that took up the whole side of one of these maps. It had a couple of side passages. It had, you know, tiered layers. The characters started high up and they had to like come down 20 and then another 20. There was pits. There was hazardous terrain. There was helpful things on the map. There was all sorts of great stuff. It wasn't just...
It was custom. It was a custom map.
It wasn't just your... You know, the monsters are on one side, the heroes are on one side. It's a flat, you know, you're in a 10 by 10 room with an orc. It's like it was this incredibly detailed map with tons of stuff going on. And it gave every character, no matter what class, what race, or how you wanted to play, different people have different play styles. There was something for everyone. And everybody found something that they enjoyed doing with this encounter. And to me, this is the pinnacle of 4E D&D. Like, this is what your encounter should be like on a regular basis. And I know personally for me in my home game, my encounters are like this quite often. And this is why my group loves D&D so much.
Not so much for me, but the pinnacle is I really, really enjoy. Going back to the map, they used to... back in March of the Phantom Brigade, back in the earlier seasons, they used to give full-page maps for all the places. I mean, this is the first time in probably two or three seasons where they've given like more than half a map. You're right. And it's the thing that I really liked is the customization behind it. It's not just a bunch of tiles put together. And I really enjoyed that. And like you said, there was a little bit of something for everybody. I don't wish anything else. It was so well done. I look at this and I'm like, they even had the darkening. They even had that 4x4 square of the darkening on there, which I think was just phenomenal in their style. I think the only criticism I would have is I wish they would have, you know, put a little bit of put the map actually as a little side inside the booklet itself, just to give us kind of an area of start area. There was a little discrepancy in where the characters start, but that's not even worth mentioning. I mean, you read it two or three times, you can kind of figure out where your players come out from, right?
Yeah. One of the things that I had to... I made a specific point about telling my players at the beginning of the adventure was everything that's on this map serves a purpose. Nothing is there by accident. Nothing is there just to make the map look pretty. So don't feel that you have to spend your standard action every round fighting monsters. It will be worth your while to do some investigation, to do some exploration, to spend the time to make the checks, to figure out what stuff is and whether it's going to help you or hurt you. And I had some players that were right on board with it. They're like, yeah, no problem. They would at first, especially early in the combat, before things really got out of hand, they were like, what's this? And can I make a check? Other players didn't care. They're like, point me to the monsters and away I go. And I think, again, that goes back to there's something for everyone. There were certainly monsters if people wanted just to do hack and slash, but there was some of that puzzle solving. Like, what is this? Why is this here? How does this interact with the encounter we're trying to do?
Well, I did something very similar. Not like you kind of said, okay, well, there's things to do. I just basically pointed out, I said, okay, well, here's a big maw with teeth, right? So I kind of made it obvious that, you know, other encounters, I never ever really pointed out any kind of the features. I pointed out the features, ledges, difficult terrain, that kind of stuff. But I kind of said, oh, you see an orange glow from around the corner. You see these crackling balls of energy that think they, you know, it may hurt you. You see further down some portals down in whatever, and you see the big column of the darkening, whatever there. And, you know, they figured it out themselves. They started asking questions after a while, and I think it's just a different style of presenting it.
Yeah, it is. It absolutely is. I think a lot of it has to do with the DM and how much information you want to provide. I mean, different DMs do things a little bit differently. And one of the things I found, especially with some of the rookie DMs, is they tend to give more information than they should up front. And I mean, it certainly makes the game run a little bit easier and things go a little smoother and the players have less to guess. Like, nothing bugs a player more than, okay, I'm going to give up my standard action to do, say, a skill check on this thing, and then to find out, oh, yeah, that was nothing. And whereas if the DM just tells you this is important, and with a history check you may learn something significant, you're more likely to actually do the check. So, I mean, it's it really comes down to the DM style. And fortunately, the DMs that I played with and the DMs that I over, like, I mean, we're all playing next to each other, so you overhear what the other guys are doing. I think everybody sort of found that right balance with their table. Everybody seemed to have a good time with it.
The when you first went in with your party, I mean, I kind of went in. I had trouble, like I said, is I had a little bit of trouble figuring out where they were coming from, because there were two basic tunnels they can come out of. But then I figured out it was the maw area. I had posted a drow by the first block of crystals. You guys will see that on the map. If you haven't played it yet, you'll see it on the map, right beside the maw. There's a crystals with. This one didn't have an artifact in it.
Because your group had four players instead of six.
Correct. So yeah. I just adjusted it accordingly. And I, funny enough, I rolled randomly, and the closest one actually didn't have an item in it. But regardless, I went up and I posted a drow there, a drow minion, one of the drow sentries.
Which was part of the description. It said each. So let's back up a second. So on the map, there's six crystals, and the description of what's happening is Loth's avatar has acquired six significant magical artifacts and has corrupted them and is using them as like focal points to make the darkening happen and to try and complete the demon weave so that Loth can become the goddess of dark magic. And so the players get a sort of, in their mind, they hear this voice, which they end up realizing is the goddess Mistra, who up until now they assumed was dead. And she basically speaks to them and says, you know, my artifacts have been corrupted. If you take care and you're able to reverse this corruption using the items of light that the players had acquired through the course of the adventure.
So this is just to clarify, the Tears of Helm, the Poppet, the Wand, the Shield, the Necklace, and the Blade.
Yeah. Then by like basically it's, you know, it's a way to give the party a clear idea of what they need to accomplish. You know, Mistress Voice says, use these items to cleanse the artifacts and by doing this you'll be able to defeat Loth. So at least that way the players realize it's not just kill the monsters, there's like a puzzle that's going on. So there's six, you could have acquired six items of light. There are six crystals on the map which represent where the artifacts are. And then it specifically said there should be a number of crystals and items equal to the number of players in the party, up to a maximum of six. So if you had less than six, the DM was supposed to, I mean, it was obviously up to the DM, pull that back. So Mark, you and I sound like we did the same thing. I had four characters in my group. I randomly determined which two artifacts on the map were not actually there. I made sure every one of the four characters had one of the four items of light, and away we went from there.
Exactly.
Yep.
And so when the players came in, I did something a little bit different. I don't know if it's a little bit different, but I had a drow sentry posted at every one of those crystals. I thought they'd get rid of the minions right away, but that's another story. But right now, is they walked in, and the drow didn't do anything. The characters saw the drow. They activated Aminator's Fury, which is the shield. They activated the brightness and actually saw what was going on, and they saw a drow just sitting there. So I let the players interact with the drow sentry, and the drow sentry answered a few questions. They tried to intimidate him, and he's like, look, he says, I don't have any more questions for you. Why don't you ask the boss? She's down there. So basically, until a character came up and actually threatened them by touching one of the crystals or trying to touch one of the crystals, the drow sentries would not attack unless Danifei gave them the order to attack.
I like that. That's definitely a way to do it. And it's a good way for characters that are good in the social skills to actually try and use some of them early on in the fight to gain some information.
And
now, are any of the players running drow characters?
No.
Okay. I was going to say, because if you were running a party that potentially could have said, hey, dude, we're here for the party. You know, it's certainly a way that you could try and bluff your way past them a little bit, but
it would have been nice. Like, but your group did. Yeah. Another thing, my group was trying to experiment with different characters this season. Usually they kind of stick with one character throughout the season. And I'm saying, you know, you want to get familiar with D&D, get familiar with some classes. So they've been trying a lot of classes this season, which is really nice to see.
Good. Cool. So how many of the minions did you end up using? Like, did you, there were supposed to be six crystals on the map, but when you scaled it back to four, did you scale back the number of minions to four, or did you keep six minions?
I kept six minions. What ended up happening is, we had discussed this earlier, because they're high armor class, none of my characters were hitting these guys.
The minions were level 12 minions. So the party being level 8, this really made the minions tough to hit. Like, yeah, armor class 26, reflex 25, will 25. Like, those numbers for most of the party, they needed like high teens to hit them. It wasn't your normal, oh, I only need an 8 or 9 to hit. It's like you needed 14 or 15 to hit them. And the same thing with my group. Like, we had a hard time taking down those minions.
Except if you're a striker, because the striker in my party had a plus 15 to hit. So, yeah.
Well, the one week we actually need, there's a guy in our group that always plays a wizard no matter what. And his tactic most rounds is, I use magic missile. And it frustrates the other players. They're like, you have fireball in your arsenal. Use it. And he's like, no, I want magic missile. I want to make sure I hit. He wasn't there for the finale. And we're like, man, we really could have used him this week. He could have just sat at the back and gone, minion with 26 armor class? I don't care. Pew, magic missile, dead. Oh, next round? Pew, magic missile, dead. No, he wasn't there. So, like, some of the minions survived well on into the late part of the fight. Yeah. We just couldn't hit them.
And they do nasty damage, too. But anyway. So what ended up happening is I'd taken two of the minions out at some point. Danifei was not bloodied, she wasn't anything of that type, but you know how she has that power, what is it, the one where she sucks Zabrak Zorlarn's life if she needed the power? She has this power that allows, you know, if she's threatened to feel, to suck power out of people. Well, I say that she sucked the power out of two of the minions and gave her two hit points. You know, they didn't know that, but I'd done that saying...
Good story way.
Yeah.
And it also sort of telegraphs that, hey, she's doing this with her minions. She may eventually do this with her, you know, more senior servant.
Exactly.
So sort of telegraph that. No, that was an interesting way to do it. So why don't you talk for a minute about Danifei? So she's tough. Tell us about her.
Danifei is Loth's avatar. At this point, I know you know a little more about the avatar thing than I do, but I would assume that this is the point where she basically takes on the persona of Loth. This is what you're trying to prevent. She's, extremely powerful, level 9 solo controller leader. I think just having her in the room without the minions, without the extra wizard, would have been a tough fight to start off with. She starts off 400 hit points. She has this amazing, amazing aura. I've never seen such a good aura. She's an amazing controller. She's allowed to slide you 3 squares. Any enemy that...
If you end your turn in the aura, you take 10 points. Poison and psychic damage, and then she can slide to 3 squares.
I think it was,
so if you're a melee guy, you're screwed.
Yeah, the variable damage itself, I mean, you know, nobody has resistance to variable damage at this level. She's allowed to double attack. She can do a ranged and a melee attack, or she can do 2 ranged attacks, 2 melee attacks. She's got this mind webs that recharges when she's first bloodied. Teleportation, she can teleport 10 squares, and it's rechargeable on a 4, 5, 6. Amazing.
So when I ran her with my small group, first thing I did was I brought her hit points down from 400 to 300. Being a party with only 4 characters, I felt that was a good starting point.
I did 250. I knew they would have trouble.
Well, now in retrospect, I think I probably should have scaled back some of the damage as well for exactly the reasons you said. With her ranged attack, she was doing 2d8 plus 9. So this was averaging around 20 points a hit. She could do this twice every round. She was hitting at least once every round. And the effect, hit or miss, was slide 3 squares. There were so many bad things on this map that you could get slid into that alone was just destroying the party. The mind webs and counterpower you talked about does 3d10 plus 9. When I rolled that the first time, I rolled a 9, a 9, and an 8. And, like, the party was decimated.
Then they were slowed, and if they failed that save, they became restrained.
Well, not only that, but it does half damage on a miss. So the one guy was all like, whoo, you missed me. I'm like, he saw me roll the dice, and he's like, oh, my God, I'm so glad you missed. And I'm like, no, well, I go, you're glad I missed, but you're still taking half damage. And then that recharges when she was bloodied. Now, fortunately for my group, I think I rolled a 1, 2, 3 the next time. So it was, you know, it was karma. It all balanced out in the end. But, yeah, it was brutal. And then she had this triggered action where every round, as an immediate reaction, if you attacked her, basically, if you hit or missed her, with a close burst 20, she could attack your will. If she hit, it did 2d8 plus 8, and you were dazed. I didn't use that power at all. I felt it was too powerful, and then honestly, I just forgot about it. And even without it, the party was just, like, getting destroyed.
I used it, but I took it down to 1d8 plus 8, and I took away the dazed. I just found it was way too overpowered.
Yeah, I think if I was to run this again, for anything less than a full party of six, I would curb back some of the powers a little bit just to sort of give them a fighting chance. I mean, we still did well, but like it was really tough. It took a long time of real time and game time, and I think the party would have just had a little bit more fun if they didn't feel so, I don't know, defeated.
This monster would have been great on a lair assault.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I can see myself using this stat block again many times for heroic tier games. Even with a few modifications, I could see it being used for like a low-level Paragon as well.
I thought it was a fantastic monster. A little overpowered, I think, for this encounter, but nonetheless, like so much fun to play as a DM, and yet my players were actually scared. They were like literally crapping their pants when they saw her.
Yeah. So now it's important to note that the Danifei's the Avatar of Loth, once you brought her to her bloody value, you couldn't bring her below that until you had cleansed a bunch of the articles now or the artifacts. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think she was in that state until you were down to only two crystals remaining. Is that correct?
Correct. You can bring her down below her bloodied value when there were two items or
two or less.
Two or less, and you had to get rid of all the items in order to kill her.
Yeah, so
you had to cleanse all the items, sorry.
Yeah, so I mean, with a party of four, there were only four items to cleanse. So with my table, they actually got the first two cleansed pretty quickly. So that wasn't a huge deal. When we had our party of six, we obviously needed to do four out of six in order to bring her down. And like we did the first two, the one up at the top by the maw, and then the one by the fire maelstrom, no problem. But we just had a hard time getting down under the main level. And then basically once she realized what we were doing, she guarded the last couple of crystals and used her controller powers to keep us away from them, which was smart from the DM. But man, was it frustrating. And but no, it was a lot of fun. And I'm glad that we had a chance to play it.
Yeah, I frustrated my characters. I did something very similar to you. She felt one of the items be cleansed. The one up by the maelstrom, that's where one of the items was. But the party was so bunched together, and she caught the top of their heads because one of the guys had actually, you know, pew-pewed her from above, like tried to do some sort of ranged attack. And I'm like, oh, no. So I played it smart, and I teleported her up right in the middle of the whole party. And from there, the aura, the bursts, the blasts, yeah, it just got them.
One of the tactics that I on the D&D forums, a couple of the DMs that post there regularly play the encounter early. They do basically the equivalent of a slot zero where they get a bunch of the DMs together to run it. I mean, if I had enough DMs in my group to run five tables, we would probably do that as well. And so they post some of their highs and lows on the board so that, you know, the rest of us can read it before Wednesday. One of the things that they had posted this week, you know, they said, look, if you think this is going to be a really tough encounter for your group, one of the tactics they suggested was not having the avatar leave the lower level, basically saying that she won't go more than a certain number of squares away from the Pillar of Darkness, and she won't teleport up onto the second level. And I thought that was a good tactic, especially with the small party, so I kept her on the low level. But when we played with our large party, the DM obviously had no qualms about it. And he, like you said, he teleported her all over the place, and he was recharging that power like every time. The only time she wasn't able to use it when she wanted to was one of the drow player characters popped his globe of darkness and trapped her inside it. So she physically couldn't see, which is the only way to stop a teleporter is to blind them. And we happened to blind her on a turn when she actually wanted to use her teleport. Other than that, every time she wanted it, boom, he rolled a 4, 5, 6. She was gone. It was so frustrating.
No, it is. It is. And she, you know, come to think of it, that would have been a good tactic for me, but I don't know. I enjoyed playing her way too much. It almost felt like the DM during Lair Assault, literally.
Yeah, no, it's tough. So a couple of the terrain things that we've sort of talked about but haven't really gone into detail, let's just cover them real quick. So one of the things is these cold fire globes, which I think you had mentioned. if you go in, if you're pushed or you're forced or you go into one of the squares that has these globes, you take 10 points of damage. It's fire, cold, lightning, so nobody's going to have all three of those resists. So you're taking the 10 points. But to add the even worse part, the 10 damage is nothing. You gain vulnerable 10 to all damage until the end of the encounter. And like, we had two of our four characters in the one game get that within the first couple of rounds. And with our other game where we had the full table, we had three guys with that. It destroyed them. Five ongoing damage doesn't sound like that much, but when you got a 10 vulnerable on top of that, and then you've got two different ongoing damages, like, you can go from full to nothing before you even get your turn.
Yeah.
It was brutal.
Well, two words for you, Derek. Pac-Man.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's a little inside joke there for fourth core team deathmatch.
Yeah.
But now on the plus side, one of the other features that I think we did talk about was, what are they called here? They're the reflecting modes. On the map, they sort of look like portals. And the way I describe them to my group is I go, think of them like giant mirrors almost, like magic mirrors. And in the mirror, you can see like this woman sort of beckoning you, like, come to me, I can help you. And it turns out that that's like an aspect of Mistra. And if you go into the reflecting mode, she negates the vulnerable, and then she gives you a saving throw. If you make the saving throw, you gain resist 5 everything till the end of the encounter. So you get a 15-point swing in the right direction on that one. She can also then teleport you to a random square that contains one of the corrupted artifacts. So not only will she help you by getting rid of your vulnerable, she can send you exactly where you need to be to make things better.
And even better, on a failed saving throw, she teleports you directly into the maelstrom. And the maelstrom at this point is that big glob of fire you'll see in the map. The big glob of fire actually allows you to recharge an encounter power that you've already used, or an encounter power of an ally within 10 squares. I believe it's 10 squares, right?
That's the heal thing. With the maelstrom, if I remember correctly, I don't have it in front of me, but it was, if I go in the maelstrom, I can recharge one of your encounter powers.
Correct. Oh, sorry. If that check is successful, the adventure enables an ally to regain the use of an encounter power.
An ally. That's right.
Yeah. So
But the caveats being, I can only recharge someone else's power once. And if you get power X recharged by me, you can't have that same power recharged by somebody else later.
Correct. But
you have to really be picky. And I know with our group, we just kept recharging the leader's heals until all the healing powers had been recharged once.
Oh, so you took it as like a leader has, let's say, three healing encounter powers. You allowed them to heal it, to do it three times?
No, we still did it once. It's just I had, like for me, I was playing a leader. I had three different encounter powers that let you heal.
Oh, okay.
So every time the players went in there, they're like, do you have a heal you've used already? I'm like, yes. And they're like, okay, I'm going to give that back to you. But we had that discussion. I said, like, look, I have Inspiring Word and I can use it twice per encounter. Can I have it recharged twice per encounter? And the DM's like, no, once. But we were able to work around it. It was fun. One guy actually recharged someone else's second wind. He's like, you're going to need this heal, and this is the only way we're going to get it to you in time.
It's an encounter power.
Yeah, exactly. It totally was. It gave the guys +2 to defenses. It gave him his healing surge, and that +2 to defenses saved his life. So, yes, again, smart tactics. One of the guys was like, I can give you back heroic effort. And we sort of went, the +4 is nice, but and that was the guy we're like, let's just give you back your second wind instead. So
cool. Another one was the corpses. So if you look at the map also, there's a whole whack of corpses lying on the ground. They describe it as being adventurers, a whole bunch of adventurers that had tried to stop Danifei beforehand. So it's a big pile of bodies, kind of like Walking Dead. And the Demon Weave has corrupted them so much that they have certain special effects on you. So if you roll a d20, the three results were the following. You're either slowed, no effect, or you gain a +4 bonus to speed until the end of your next turn. So this is basically a random die 20 roll, and that's how that went.
Yeah, of all the things on the map, this is the one I thought was kind of meh. It didn't really seem to add anything. I mean, difficult terrain, fine. I didn't have a problem with that. But this other effect was the only one that sort of seemed really out of place to me. I wasn't wild about it. I still used it, but I didn't really love it. The one that I did that was one of my favorites was there's this dragon corpse. It's like the bones of a dragon. And this is right out of one of the old dungeon tile sets. And you used to see it thrown into some of the Living Front Realms ones. And it was always just sort of a dungeon dressing. It was never anything significant. I mean, it was difficult terrain, but that was it. In this case, what happened was the first time somebody steps on the bones basically blow up. and anyone who's on the bones or adjacent to the bones takes damage. Now, the first time someone did this in my game, there was a minion standing next to the bones. Boom, dead. Perfect, which was great because they had tried attacking and couldn't hit his defenses. So this was a good way to take him down. Then what happens is this, it describes it as the remains of a gold dragon. So it says the spirit of the gold dragon emerges from the bones and basically says, like, hey, what's going on? And the background that's provided for the DM is this gold dragon realized bad stuff was going on here, came to investigate, thinking, I'm powerful, I'm a dragon, and Loth just decimated him. So the spirit is like, what's going on? And the character had a chance to use a diplomacy check as a standard action to try and inspire the dragon. You know, we're here to stop Loth. You should help us. And if you were successful, I mean, it wasn't a hard check. It was only a 12 diplomacy check. If you're successful, the dragon spirit automatically does 10 points of damage every round to Danifei for the rest of the fight. And if you were fortunate enough to get her into one of the effects that gave her vulnerability, which we were in both of my games, that 10 points plus the vulnerable started to really add up fast. At my table, when I was running it, I actually have a gold dragon mini, the 3x3 base. So I actually put that on the map. And as soon as the players saw that, they were like, holy crap, we got to fight a dragon? It's like, no, it's a gold dragon. Good guy. And so they realized, oh, my God, this is something here to help me. And by leaving it on the map, it really inspired the players. They're like, oh, my God, we're going to win this. We got a dragon on our side. It was amazing how just that little visual piece that was added to the thing through the mini was it really just turned the players around because they were really getting down in the dumps before that.
I'm pretty ticked off. I forgot to bring my minis too.
Yeah, no, when I played it at the second table, I said to the DM before, I'm like, you know, if we end up getting the dragon and you want, I have the dragon mini with me. And he's like, no, we're good. We're good. I mean, you know, certainly don't need it, but I saw how positively it affected my table the first time that, you know, I was a little bit disappointed that he didn't use it, but I mean, it certainly wasn't necessary. At the second table when we ran it, when the spirit showed up, like the heroes were like, oh yeah, we're going to get it. Like they got it right away. Like a dragon's going to be on our team. We're going to be, you know, team heroes plus dragon. So yeah, no, it was really good. I thought that was a really good add on to the encounter. Like I love the encounter, but this was my favorite sort of little detail that really, you know, made it go from good to great for me.
Yeah. Going back for the corpses, just quickly, I just wanted to comment on something you said earlier. I found that it actually added a little bit of flavor. I kind of did the whole nauseousness, so you become slowed. You kind of slip and fall on your knees on all the blood and everything, and you end up swallowing some of it. You feel nauseous. You're not feeling good this round. You know, I did a little bit of that kind of flavoring. So anyway, I just want to add that.
Well, and I mean, you know, we're not both going to love everything
exactly
or hate everything the same. So I'm kind of glad to hear that you know, some of the groups actually found this interesting.
The ledges were, I find, the toughest part of this encounter.
I thought they were useless. Anyway, continue. Tell us about the ledges.
Yeah, the ledges, I found it very difficult. Parties don't normally, you know, ledges are ledges. You climb down, you climb up, you climb down, you climb up. I house ruled, just for simplicity's sake, all these acrobatics checks to get down ledges. The fight was tough enough. So I said that they can climb down at their regular speed, all that kind of stuff. Now, I know you did something kind of cool. You kind of gave the players an ability or an option to figure out that the ledges can actually be knocked down.
Yeah, I mean, that's printed in the adventure that this is a possibility. But in my mind, it's exactly like you said. The players rarely are going to take time to investigate a ledge. They're busy fighting monsters. So I know with my group, once they actually were standing on the ledge, I just said to them, you realize, you know, I read it. I'm like, the ledges are not stable. You figure if you hit it in the right place with the right amount of force, it could just knock the ground out from underneath someone. The advantage of this was if you were fighting a monster and you were worried you weren't going to hit them, you might have an easier chance of making this dungeoneering check. And I know that at our large table, this is exactly what happened. Danifei teleported up. She had all of us in her aura. And we were like, crap, we're all going to take this damage on our turn. The first guy to attack, he didn't have any powers that had force movement. So he instead attacked the ground, made the dungeoneering check, and knocked the ground out from under her, forcing her to fall the 20 feet and taking the 2d10 damage. Because it specifically says you don't get a save to catch the ledge, she was gone and we were out of the aura. Later in the combat, we actually were in a similar situation where we were trying to push her off the ledge. We didn't realize that as a solo controller leader, she has a +5 to save. She was going to catch that ledge every time, and she did. She caught the ledge every time. So in retrospect, this was the only way to get her off the ledge in a hurry. But yeah, to me, it was, this is the one piece in this whole description that I thought we really could have done without it. This was just another level of detail that by the time I got to it, I'm just like, it's starting to bog things down.
And the green blob was in the bad spot too. The green blob allowed you to do an arcana check for those that are trained in arcana and add 2d10 force damage on a successful hit. On a successful check, the character's next attack deals 2d10 extra force damage. And you'll see in the map, it's just in a really bad placement.
Yeah. The only reason I would... the two groups I did, nobody went anywhere near this.
True.
It was
neither me.
It was interesting, but it was in a bad spot. I think if you were in a group where, say, you had a warlock who had that pact where you can teleport when a guy drops, potentially he could get up on that ledge really easily, really quickly. Or if you had a ranged character, maybe an Eladrin ranger who was like, oh, I got to get somewhere high where I can just shoot down on the crowd. Maybe, but considering how much grief people were having with the up and down the ledges already, nobody was going over there to try and climb up and investigate this blob. It just... Again, that's another one that I was okay with it. I just thought that it was so remote from the rest of the battle that it didn't add anything. I would have removed that, and I would have removed the detail about the ledges.
Yeah. Well, the most boring feature in this whole map is the water. I mean, come on. You get this huge description for all the other ones, and then you got water. This pool is difficult terrain.
Yeah, like why even include the water? It didn't add anything.
I'm kidding. I was just being jokey because... You know, you got all these other cool things going on, and then all of a sudden you got the water, which is the normal thing, right? On anybody that's around adventures knows that there's water.
We have a long standing in joke in our group that whenever you see a pool of water, you always check it for treasure. Because this one adventure years and years ago, we fought a dragon in its lair, and we had the map set up, and then the DM's like, "What are you doing now?" And it was towards the end of the night, so we're like, "Well, let's just move on to get the next encounter done." And then someone decided a couple minutes later to go, "Hey, did we ever search for treasure?" And the DM went, "No, it was all in the water. Nobody said they looked there. You don't get any treasure." And we're like, "Are you kidding me?" So ever since then, whenever there's water on any map, the first thing we do before we even kill a monster, somebody always checks the water for treasure.
Well, maybe that's why it's important and written in here. Awesome.
Yeah, maybe. So.
All right. At the end, Mistra appears.
Yes,
oh, sorry.
Does.
I guess we didn't talk about killing. Did you? How quickly did your players figure out that Danifei can go beyond her bloodied level? Did they figure this out with Arcana checks? Did you make them do Arcana checks or what?
I just said that once she hit her bloodied value, if they hadn't gotten rid of the artifact, she was taking no additional damage. So until they got down to just two remaining.
Right.
She was shrugging off everything, and I made it very clear after the first person connected. I'm like, she shrugs it off because there's a little speech she's supposed to give that's supposed to tip the characters as to what's going on. And then I actually like how you had suggested, like, that if she had been able to absorb hit points from the minions, it sort of would telegraph that later on in the combat, once you bring her down to zero, she sucks the life force out of the other wizard, and then basically she gets his hit points back. Now, of course, by that point, he's probably bloodied as well. So he's only got 20 or 30 hit points. But it might let her live long enough to do a few more attacks, which may be all that she needs to take another guy out of the party. Who knows?
True.
So how did things end?
Well, mine ended TPK. It's my my characters, they went through, they got their encounters recharged. They did all that stuff. But there's just something about the way that they were placed. They were taking too much damage every round. I would have had to take away her aura. I would have to take away a lot of her powers. And to me, you know what? I'm sorry. Tactically speaking, they weren't very tactical. And
but your players are relatively inexperienced, right? Like, they haven't been playing D&D that long.
Correct. And it wasn't a bad thing. I mean, we talked about it afterwards, and they just thought it was a fantastic fight, and they even attributed it to bad tactics. And I'm saying, yeah, you know what? It's bad tactics. So you just become another, you know, couple of bodies that end up doing, you know, that end up slowing or speeding people up. And they were fine with that. And actually, I don't know if we're allowed to do this, but it's not organized play. You know how we have that lull between encounter seasons?
Yeah.
Well, this time we're going to actually replay the encounter. They know what's there. We're going to replay the encounter and see how they do again. Kind of like do a layer assault thing.
Almost like a do-over.
Yeah, just for fun, just to see if they can actually beat it.
That may not be a bad idea. I may suggest that to my group as well, because everybody seemed to really like this one and the troll encounter too, people like. But I mean, trolls are just one kind of monster. After you do that fight, I don't think you necessarily need to do it again. But you know, this ended up being really good. It was quite enjoyable.
Well, I would change a couple of tactics as DM myself also. I would probably take into consideration the number of people I have at the table. And once again, you know, having Lul's avatar just teleport right into the fray right away is, you know, it's kind of like she's cocky. So if she's cocky, then why would she be worried about one item being?
Yeah, exactly. Before we finish up, I just want to share a couple of really cool things that happened at our table. And believe me, there was a lot of them. First, really creative with the teleporting maw at the beginning. We had one of our guys is playing like a brawler fighter, and he's got like, I think he's got a plus 18 athletics. Like, it's crazy how high his number is. He basically said, okay, this is what I want to do. He saw the first guy get teleported out, and he's like, I'm not going near it. He goes, I want to climb up the wall and basically scale across the ceiling above the maw so that I'm well out of its reach. And we all sort of looked at each other and went, that's a fantastic idea. But none of us had athletic score high enough to even do it. But he rolled amazing. And the DM's like, that's a great idea. And we're like, it just sort of set the tone for be creative. The DM's going to let it go. And it was a really good start to the encounter. Another interesting tactic that somebody did later in the combat, once the wizard was bloodied, same thing. You couldn't hurt him below his bloodied value until the avatar was dead. So the wizard was running around just doing damage round after round after round. One of the guys decided to try and slide him into the pit, which he eventually did. The pit's 30 feet down. The guy didn't take any damage, even though it was 3d10 damage. But you're immobilized at the bottom of the pit. The wizard failed that immobilized save 5 or 6 rounds in a row.
Oh, that was lucky.
It was very lucky. And then he had to climb out. Well, he's a wizard. His athletic score is terrible. It took him like another 3 rounds to climb out of the pit. By the time he came out of the pit, that was the round we got Danifei down to 0. And she just literally saw him climbing out of the pit and turned to him and went, yeah, I need your life force, buddy. So for 9 rounds, he was removed from combat. And the one round when he got back up and could have participated, she just toasted him. So again, it was a good tactic by one of the players. I think he had to use an encounter power at a point where it was going to do no damage, but he knew it let him slide the monster, and boom, the drow went down in the pit, which was great. With our other group, one of the guys intentionally went in the pit because he was trying to avoid the aura, and he knew that the pit was deep enough that he wouldn't take the damage. So that was kind of funny. And then when you get down there, one of the corpses from one of the heroes that was down there from previous had a healing potion out. So he managed to jump in the pit, took no damage because he was trained in acrobatics, found this potion, drank it, healed up, avoided the damage from the aura. All in all, the pit saved his life. And so that was kind of neat as well. And then one of the other really cool things was we had a barbarian in our group, and he just needed to cover enough distance to get to the avatar. And he was on the middle level of the ledge. So he does a running jump. He needs to clear, I think he needed to roll like 15 or higher to get enough squares, to cover enough squares with his athletics check to get the distance he needed to get there. So he's like, I'm going to run, jump, and then basically turn it into a charge so that I can swing with a basic attack when I get where I'm going. He was barbarian. He had an encounter power. So the DM allowed it. He rolled amazing on his athletics check. No problem. He covered the distance. No problem. He's also trained in acrobatics. The DM's like, I'll let you roll to avoid the damage. So the DM rolls 11 points of damage. He's like, you need to roll a 22 or higher on your acrobatics check to negate this. He rolled 22 right on the money. Boom. Lands on his feet, swings, rolled, I think, an 18 or a 19 on the attack dice, and it was a 4-weapon attack. And he just, oh, yeah, it was awesome. It was so much damage. And it was like everyone's like jumping up and high-fiving. We're like, that was amazing. It was, the group was just, they could do no wrong. Anything they could think of, they tried. It was awesome. We had so much fun tonight.
That's cool. My group, unfortunately, had really bad rolls. It was overall kind of a dud night for rolls in terms of the party, but we still had a lot of fun.
Yeah, everybody yeah. That played tonight had a blast. Even the DMs, I know when, as a DM, when I ran it, I mean, I had a great time running it, and afterwards I thought, geez, I could have done this better and that better, but the players really liked it. And same thing with the second group. The guy who was the DM, after he said, he's like, you know, this was one of the sessions I had the most fun running. So yeah, no, I think it was a really, really good adventure. It was a really, really good encounter tonight.
Now last,
it was a great conclusion.
Yeah, definitely. The Darkening, did it do any? Did you make it do any damage? Did anybody go into the Darkening itself?
I think it said that you couldn't willfully go into it, but if you were pushed into it, you got to save. If you failed to save, you took 10 damage. Nobody tried to go in it. Nobody tried to get pushed in it. It was almost a little bit anticlimactic. It's like, this is the whole thing that the adventure is about, the Darkening. And the Darkening wasn't even really a big factor in the combat.
Oh, well. You kill Danafe, stop the Darkening. It's all good.
And, of course, the big dun-dun-dun reveal is that the goddess Mistra comes back to life to stop Loth from becoming the goddess of magic, destroys all the Darkening, makes the pillar of magic go back to being light instead of dark, and Mistra is now back as a part of the Forgotten Realms, and that's sort of the conclusion of the adventure. The heroes have the satisfaction of knowing that part of what their actions were, part of their deeds, helped bring the goddess of magic back to the realm. So it's an extremely heroic ending. In my mind, a very satisfying ending for what's been a very thrilling season of D&D Encounters.
I agree. 100%. They do say that magic's not as powerful because Mistress does have to do a lot of work to bring the Demon Weave to what it was beforehand, etc. But, yeah, I guess we'll be seeing probably some Forgotten Realms novels on Mistress' reintroduction into Forgotten Realms.
Yeah, no, I'm looking forward to them.
Same here. Excellent. Well, I guess the next season isn't for next till February 7th, correct? Or week zero is January 27th or something?
We got a month. Yeah, there hasn't been a lot of detail revealed yet, but I guess once we've got the packets, we'll do some preview, and then we'll get back to the show once the next season of Encounters begins.
Definitely. Excellent. So this concludes D&D Encounters Season 11, War of Everlasting Darkness, Session 8, The Spell Caves of Rinlin. Join us as Derek and I will possibly discuss at some point this month or coming up other things that are relevant to D&D Encounters.
Indeed. If time permitting, maybe we'll do a sort of a season recap on what we liked and didn't like of the season. Although if you've been listening to all the episodes, it'll basically be a condensed version of the 8 episodes. But you never know. We'll see what else we can come up with to keep our listeners interested.
Definitely. Well, until then, we'll talk to you guys later.
Have a blast. You can follow me on Twitter at @Amaron_DM, and be sure to visit dungeonsmaster.com for original D&D 4th edition material, including a weekly field report of my D&D Encounters experiences.
And follow me on Twitter at 20foot, and visit 20footradius.blogspot.com for your weekly dose of D&D Encounters. That's 20footradius20ft.radius.blogspot.com. Until then, have a blast.